Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
Nigeria. We also transmit on live radio 107.5 FM in Oyo State. My name is A.G. Ahmed, your regular host. Dr. Strawn weekly brings evidence-based, up-to-date, relatable health information by health practitioners and those associated with delivering healthcare to the public. Today, as usual, we should start the program by asking our guest several questions in his area of specialization. And remember, listeners, this program is your program and you can call it at all times. We're focusing today on regulation of the practice of medicine. Physicians' Oath or Geneva Declaration, a modification of the Hippocratic Oath, reads, "I will practice my profession with conscience and dignity. The health of my patient will be my first consideration. I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from its beginning, even though I may be under threat. I will not use my medical knowledge contrary to the laws of humanity." This is the modification of the original Hippocratic Oath, and every physician all over the world takes this oath to practice medicine, both the science and the art of medicine. This oath underlines the principle of a vocation of medicine that renders help to the helpless and protect humanity. However, every organized system and process needs to go beyond promise. There's a need to have some form of oversight and regulation. This is more so in medical practice, given the sensitive nature of medicine, the power imbalance, and the vulnerability of the wounded, the sick, and the afflicted. As many African nations and societies are, the healthcare system is a derivative of the colonial medical services, there appear to be similarities in the way medicine is being practiced and regulated across Africa. In Nigeria, the statutory responsibility of regulating the practice of medicine and dentistry lies on the Medical and Dental Council of Nigeria. And this is well entrenched and well spelled out under the Medical and Dental Practitioner Act, CAP 221 of the Federal Republic. The duties and responsibility include setting up standards, ensuring that those standards are kept, and reviewing from time to time how these standards are in keeping with the code of conduct. In Ontario, where I practice and where our guest speaker is a member of the College of Physicians and Surgeons, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario is charged with similar statutory responsibility. The college plays a key role in Ontario's health system by regulating the practice of medicine. This includes licensing, monitoring and maintaining standard for doctors. The ultimate goal, wherever it is that this regulation is in place, is to foster professional practice of medicine and protect the public from unprofessional, improper, and incompetent action of doctors. What do we then mean by regulation? Who regulates what? Why do we even need to regulate? Do the regulators represent the interests of us as public? Your interests, my interests. These are some of the questions we'll be asking today. And our guest will be talking from his experience as a member of the Council of the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons. Our guest is Fred Sherman. Beyond the college, Mr. Sherman has other responsibilities as the chief executive of Hills Solution, a public affairs firm based in Canada's capital, Ottawa, through which he provides counsel to some of the best and the brightest in government, business, and politics. Mr. Sherman has also trained teachers and military officers, public officers for global deployment. He has advised nationwide. He's an experienced instructor, a journalist. Mr. Sherman is a graduate of political science and public administration, and he also served on the board of several organizations. I can go on and on and on and on. But let me not take more time. I'd like to welcome Fred. Fred, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, my brother AG. I want to, first of all, thank you for this opportunity and also kind of convey that gratitude also to your team there, your wonderful team. Doctors Round, I think, is providing such an essential service. First of all, not only in terms of informing people about the very, very important work that people in the medical profession do, but also in terms of being a representative of what we aspire to in this greater African diaspora. You know that we are Black people, we're African people, and we also are competent and effective in making a difference. So thank you and your team, and I welcome this opportunity to kind of exchange information and ideas on the way ahead.
Thank you very much. You're most welcome. As usual, we're going to start this show by inviting our regular here, LJ Daddy. He may have some questions for you. LJ Daddy, good evening, good afternoon, good day, wherever you are.
Hello, sir. Hello, Oga, sir. Oga from the college.
Hello, LJ. Hello, LJ Daddy. How are you?
I'm hearing all the big grammar and everything. Please, sir, I need your help. My friend's son is studying in Canada. When he come back from Canada, in fact, there was big party. The father said he was now doctor. We had a big party for him, as doctor. Ah, the party was big. Then one day, when one of the twins was sick, they were coughing with fever. We called him. We said, please, doctor, help us. The twin is sick. He said, uncle, my own daughter is doctor of book from Toronto. I'm wondering, I didn't know that book can be sick. He said, I said, but you're a doctor. We do party for you as a doctor. He said, no. That in Canada, everyone you can check. That when you check Google from in Ontario, you can check about doctor. So he showed me how to check. We check. True, his name was not there. But I saw the name of many other doctors. In Ontario, there, you can see the name of the doctor, the type of doctor, whether it's baby doctor, bone doctor, and all that. You can see when they study the book. You can even see when doctor entered trouble. Doctor entered trouble. Every day we write it there. It's very wonderful. But where we are, we can't share anything about doctor like that. So I don't know. Is it a good thing? Very. Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. This is LJ Daddy, like Sissy Jacob. Thank you.
LJ, thank you so much for your very, very spirited question. And I certainly welcome that. And I think, my brother, what you are saying is, first of all, we need to understand what being a doctor really means. You know, how can one come in and profess to be a doctor, but at the same time is not in a position to do what perhaps in that situation would be needed? So by that, I say to you and your my brother, your AG can tell you that medicine itself, or just the whole notion of PhD doctors, right? That's so vast. You know, when you even just stay within the medical realm, the areas of specialization is has vast, has the amount of parts on your body. You know, you got eye specialist, nose specialist, mouth specialist, heart, brain, and neurosurgeon, so on and so forth. So when someone comes to be and conveys that he or she is a doctor, then we have questions. And you have to be very, very careful. And I think what you're also suggesting is exactly why we're doing this show, why there has to be some sort of a regulatory capacity. In other words, a means by which we can see for sure this person is or is not a doctor.
Interesting.
That sums it really, and you'll be shedding more light on this. But first and foremost, Fred, I just have to congratulate you. You represent us at the college, and you've done a great deal of things. You and I had there was a piece that we wrote in Black Ottawa Sin. I mean, when I came across you, and it still baffles me. Here you are. You are the journalist. I'm the doctor. We're swapping role here. This is role reversal. What are you doing at the college? At the college? You're a journalist, for God's sake.
Oh, my God. You know, I am a fan, so much a fan of you, sir, and OG, AG. We've known each other for so very long. And yes, in fact, you have so much depth and dimension to your personality and your persona. You know, you are very, very good in your space of professional vocation, but I've also seen you be very, very skillful in other spaces as well. So you with the pen in your hand, I'm very, very confident that as your listeners would probably suggest that you with a microphone in front of you, you're also very, very competent. But I'll tell you this much. First of all, it's a tremendous responsibility and an honor, obviously, to be doing what I'm doing. As you mentioned in your notes earlier on, my professional vocation is within the public affairs sphere, and I've, as you know, embraced that opportunity to do as much. And I think what is important or of significant interest to your listeners is how those of us who are people of Africa in this diaspora, what are we effectively doing to kind of represent a positive image, continue the positive dialogue of what is the vast competency that is Africa. So when we enter these roles, you as a medical professional, me as a public member on a medical body as such, I don't only come there as if I'm Fred Sherman for Fred Sherman, but I come there being fully cognizant of the tremendous responsibility, whether I like it or not, tremendous impact and example that all my actions and thoughts and manifestations will imply or signal for the rest of the diaspora. In other words, if I'm a black man there, I don't perform well, you know, and then they're looking at all black people and say, well, there we go, they don't perform well. But the CPSO itself has, you know, being a regulatory body, it's very, very significant in the sense that we specifically are entrusted with the notion of representing the people of Ontario. In other words, we the college itself, I'll break it down. I'm on a council, so I'm on the governing body of the college. The college itself has four core activities. Number one, the registration component, as you alluded to in your introduction, you know, decisions are required to be members of the college to practice. And that also answers LG Daddy's question earlier. You have to be registered, so officially registered, and then obviously there's certain criteria. And AG, you do this every year. And I don't know if we talk money on this, but we know that you have to fork out almost $2,000 a year to remain a physician. And there's all these other terms and components you have to do. So in the province of Ontario, I believe just under 15,000 physicians for a population of about 13 million. So we have a very, very strong ratio there. There's now coming to the core question about regulation. Why would someone like me, who is not a doctor, be brought onto that body? If you put a whole bunch of, and rightfully so, very, very competent physicians around a table, well, necessarily, they speak a different language. They have different, sort of this collegial space. And in certain instances, they may not see certain things that a general member of the public can see, you know, or even on the shorter end of the stick, they might even know each other, you know. So we don't, what we do by putting public members in this process is sort of a check and balance. Now, I'm going to shut up for a little bit, Iggy, because I can go on and on, you know, as I've been.
I know you, Fred, and you've answered my question. So really, you're there to represent the public. You're there to give the voice to the voiceless, to ensure that the physicians do what they're supposed to do. You're there to ensure that we continue to help the helpless, the wounded, and the sick.
That's right.
Now, the CPSO has its mission. What aspect of the mission appeals to you most as a public advocate and as a change maker? I mean, you've been in different fields.
There's so much exciting stuff happening there right now. And I kind of hate to say this, but it's so obvious. In fact, because when I say hate to say this, I mean, it seems cliche, but it's so important. The death of George Floyd, for those of us in North America, I mean, around the world, wherever, but for those of us who live here, has catalyzed so much over the last year and a half or so since this man was tragically taken away in clear public sight. And what has happened across civil society and institutions of governance, et cetera, is this very, very conscious and overt effort towards bringing in this sort of systemic change that is needed, you know. And as you and I discussed in our article back in February, AG, we don't know how long it's going to be, how permanent it's going to be, but nonetheless, we embrace it and we work in it. So coming to the college, when you asked me about what's exciting there, I think the whole diversity and inclusion component, you know. I'm not in all the rooms, but all the ones I'm in, and I would also suspect it's happening others, that seems to be one of the lenses by which we are actually operating. Now, explain further, there's four core things we do at the college. I mentioned registration also. There's also this quality component, which, again, AG, you'll be aware of. In other words, doctors are kind of encouraged to continue and provide the tools to continually improve themselves, learn best practice, sort of self-monitor, self-govern themselves to keep getting better. That's a quality component. The third component is investigations and disciplines. You know, so there's various tribunals and bodies, subcommittees, if you will, that we participate on to do the work. I tend to serve on one called the Investigations Committee, ICRC, the Investigations, Complaints, and Reports Committees. This is when we're actually looking at public complaints that have been lodged against physicians and medical practitioners. And lastly would be the Guiding Professional Conduct component. So notions of equity and policy development to provide physicians sort of this legislative regulatory regime and requirements and expectations to kind of maintain and sustain the integrity of the medical profession. So what is exciting is a diversity and inclusion perspective. I personally am also very, very much interested in a technological and innovation component, because I think for countries like Nigeria, you know, I'll give another example that is non-medical within the context of how important technology innovation is. You know, number one, for example, in North America, we have this very sophisticated grid of, cable wires and fiber and wire optics, so on and so forth, to sustain our telecommunications infrastructure. And these things were supposed to be amortized over about 50 to 75 years. But then all of a sudden, technology brought us the mobile phone. Now, Africa does not have to go through that stage where we go and install all these fiber optics. So technology brought us forward, bam, just like that. We look at the COVID and the recent, space at which we were able to figure out these vaccines. You know, before heading into COVID, we knew that that gestation period, correct me if I'm wrong, AG, was 8 to 12 years for us to have a solid efficacious vaccine will take about 8 to 12 years, you know, but we did it in less than a year. So that's why you have this dynamic of people who are anti-vaccine. They don't trust the vaccine and all that nonsense. But anyway, to wrap up my point here, I think the fact that we have technology that excites me now, because that says to us that we can actually speed up the way and pace at which Africa can embrace. We have the mental capacity. We have the technological know-how in terms of that mental capacity to learn. But now, in terms of putting in that sophisticated infrastructure to allow us to deliver better patient care, I think it's exciting. So those are two things, diversity and then the technology piece. Those two really have me excited.
Just borrowing on that diversity, I think it's something that is worth embracing, because if you look at the regulatory body in most African countries, Nigeria in particular, I think it's about time. I'm not too sure about the components, but it's about time that you start getting non-physicians playing active role like yourself, being involved in investigation and making this public. LJ Daddy told us that, you know, when he went to search for his friend's son that came, he was able to find out what the specialty is, whether this individual, what kind of doctor he is. He had a PhD, but he's not actually a doctor. I mean, he's not a medical doctor. So that is fascinating. And of course, there's no doubt about it, with the Floyd case, there's increased sensitivity that allow you to be involved, that allow other Africans and Nigerians to be involved in determining the being a voice. This leads me to the next question. How has the process of joining the council on your first, I mean, you've been there now since February this year. Yeah, you know, how has that shaped your perspective of what can be achieved through the organization? How has that
shaped that tremendously? And thanks for that question. That's a powerful one, because just to put it in simple terms, you know, what I've done all my career, I've sat on so many bodies before, right? And sometimes we have a tendency, those of us who find best practices and efficiencies of scale, so we call it mail it in. You know, you do some prep the night before the committee meeting, and maybe in the morning you go and check. What this serving on the CPSO forces me to actually do the work. I actually, first of all, you want to show up ready, because you're dealing and making decisions that are impacting people's lives. In some instances, it's decisions of life and death and sanctioning thereof. So I started to realize after several months that, wait a minute, this is no joke. This is not just you showing up. I mean, somewhere, someday, every decision and action that I make in this space is affecting a life. And what I also noticed as I work with the other thing that came to my attention, I didn't realize, was a statutory obligation that I be at every meeting. In other words, if I do not show up for that meeting, me being a public member, that meeting will not happen. And sometimes there's anywhere from $14,000 to $35,000 of investment or, you know, operational costs involved in each of those meetings in terms of people around the table. The facility booking, we have medical advisors in these meetings. We have on screen, because a lot of them on Zoom right now because of COVID. So I'll see about maybe 7 or 8 or 9 frames on the window, right? But if you visualize those formal hearings, I think we have some in Nigeria as well, but I mean, I am most familiar with them here in Canada and the United States, where you have legislators on a panel and you have a room full of professionals. That's exactly what is being replicated in Zoom, because I will look at the number of participants in that room and you have 57, 58 people, even though there's only 8 of us on screens, but those are medical advisors, legal advisors, other key stakeholders. And all these people will have to stay home if Fred Sherman does not show up at that meeting. The meeting will not happen. So I understand how significant a role and how trusted a role I have. And then that also carries on in the actual performance or conduct of the meeting. We usually all are given cases beforehand. Cases can range from 60 pages to I think the highest one I had was just over 3,000 pages. Now we're looking at all the records, the doctor's records in respect or regards of that particular patient, you know, and then you kind of find your way to get some sort of a disposition. And there's a collegial sort of collaborative approach. This all happens online between myself and the other doctors. I have developed some best practices where I wait for the professionals to go first, because you guys know how to talk about the latissimus dorsi and the, you know, and stuff like all these little heavy multi-dimensional Latin terms. But I kind of look for the common sense thread there, the simplistic human compassion. And I'm very, very impressed with the doctors, because they come around, you know, they get caught up in a shop talk. They go so deep in there sometimes. And I said, guys, let's just bring it back. Here's a mom or a dad who just lost a kid, you know, and they want answers, you know. So it's not just about us kind of finding, you know, what the medical situation is, but in a holistic way, what can we say to these parents to make them feel good about what they do? So the short answer now, what I enjoy about what I do there, what I think is significant, I think it's more significant than I thought it was when I entered in here.
Interesting. So you really put the human face to this, all these technical terms that we do.
Yeah.
You represent the public. You speak for the public, and you look at it from that point of view. Interesting. Well, you're still listening to Doctor's Round on Spirit of Nigeria Radio and live radio on 107.5 FM. And this is a program in partnership with CHERN, Transforming, Uplifting, and Reforming Nigeria. We're talking about regulation of the practice of medicine in Ontario and lessons for Nigeria. Before we go on break, I'd like to ask you this question. You can just briefly address it. You talk about public engagement, public advocacy. How do you get the public? How do you seek engagement with advocacy? You know, how do you seek that? How do you get other people to relate? And if you want to expatiate on the historical issue, fine. But I'm just thinking of how you get this public engagement with the job that you do.
Well, you remember, public, it's so interesting, because you remember the moment this happened, I was on the phone, they say, AG, these people are trying to get me to come here.
That's it. You're public radio, man.
What am I going to do here, you know? But you really don't, because, you know, the advocacy component is self-prescribed, right? Because, again, I recognize I'm a Black man, an African man, and representing that story. And when I come in there, every room I enter, you know, the tone will change by virtue of people seeing me in that room. So I think the advocacy piece happens by virtue of your natural, unofficial outreach and engagement, talking to people. So I've had, between you and me, very, very good conversations with people that I think are uniquely positioned to give me good advice. But and then also kind of reading the papers, reading the news, kind of seeing what's going on there. So there's a real good, and to kind of wrap it up, because I know you have to go to break, there's a real good public narrative there when you see this whole conversation, and that's an important piece here that's happening around COVID and people not wanting to take that vaccination. So I got some good insight there.
Interesting. So your appearance speaks for itself.
Oh, yeah.
Your appearance does a lot of job. Mm-hmm. So maybe if we, I don't know, Toye, are you able to give us some nice humor, Sekela? I don't know what you have lined up for us. Any music? This guy loves his music. Why he speaks the common man's language. What do you think, Toye? Are you there?
Thank you.
Well, welcome back. You cannot dance away. We've got a lot of work to do here, Fred. I understand. Sadly, we've lost Professor Victor Owaifo, one of the Nigerian legends in high life music. And that particular number was actually a staple in any Nigerian party. I think Jeremy is well celebrated. So that's a beautiful music. I was going to get you, give you a humor, Sekela, but the studio has its mind. Not to worry. Next time, we'll teach you to that. Welcome back to our listeners. You're still listening to Doctor's Round on Spirit of Nigeria Radio. And our guest is Fred Sherman, a member of the Council of Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons. By the way, do you guys, every college that I know offers diploma, certificate. Does the CPSO offer diploma and certificate? It's a college.
We actually regulate in that area as well, in terms of to make sure that there are some, if you will, learning opportunities that we certify. You know, so by virtue of the fact that we certify you to be able to practice in the province of Ontario, we also deal with the young students, the students, the pre-medical students, and so on and so forth. So there is, in fact, some licensing components that we put out. They're very, very comprehensive modules, though. So in that way, we do, I guess.
So you offer licenses. You offer licenses because actually what comes to everybody's mind, Nigeria, they talk about Nigerian Medical and Dental Council. Mm-hmm. You are a college, but your college licenses is not a degree awarding institution. For people to clarify.
Clarification, absolutely.
Yes. How does the CPSO effectively regulate and oftentimes act as a tribunal to improve healthcare? What's your role? You touch on it earlier.
It's quite actually quite dynamic and exciting. I remember that's one of the first things that really, really impacted me because, yes, you have this huge, sophisticated infrastructure, but at the same time, I think the focus gets down to parsing it to the individual level, and it comes back to people like yourself, AG, the doctors, the physicians there. I mean, within the tribunal construct, right, this college has moved away, and we try to move away from more of this punitive type engagement to a remediative type engagement. In other words, you know, we try to work with doctors and medical practitioners, primarily doctors, I guess. I keep saying medical practitioners, but it's just the physicians, the doctors, I guess, to kind of, you know, make sure that you as good as you can be. I talked about quality early as one of the things we do. And by that, we provide all these tools, these modules, these learning opportunities at all aspects, you know. But when you look at the larger regulatory framework, we have obviously a strategic plan, all right? And it's 5-year grid, and there's 5 core components we talk about. We talk about right touch regulation, which basically involves us kind of really making sure that we apply a proportionate, consistent, targeted, if you would, transparent, agile approach to all aspects of medical regulation. That means engaging, reaching out, talking to people, talking to the doctors and making sure that we get things done. Secondly, was the quality care component. I already spoke about that. But again, we use evidence to calculate any value of risk and address the greatest concerns for patient care. So in other words, we're trying to build a better, more supportive environment that can guide and support doctors throughout their entire career. So that was right touch regulation, number one. Secondly, was quality care. Third was something we call continuous improvement. And again, these are not just jargon, but it's like infrastructural pieces, actual steps and processes that we put in place to achieve continuous improvement, you know, sort of foster a culture of continuous change, the modernization pieces, whether it's software and new equipment, where it's technology innovation, but again, continuously trying to find ways to improve how you deliver service care to your patients, your general constituency. Next would be system collaboration. Again, just working around, not only within ourselves as a medical organization, but also working with government and other sectors of society. If you look, for example, in the example of Nigeria, you know, you would start asking questions, as LJ Daddy posed earlier on. You know, we have all these talented, powerful, competent people within the space. Powerful means mentally powerful, competent people within the space. But how do we start crossing T's and dotting I's to take advantage of technology to be able to provide the best possible care for Nigerians, you know, for Nigerian people? So I think as I leave that there, I'll go, I don't want to finish without talking about the last piece being meaningful engagement. Again, it's just that continuous stakeholder dialogue, making sure that the public you serve, that you're also receiving input from them, you know, involving patients, involving the public and physicians into the college, you know. So whatever your central regulatory body may be, you mentioned the doc, dental, and medical, having them kind of reach out, take the information that is out there, that doctors who are on the front line providing the services know and understand what the patients experience, and then fold that back into the process. Before we went on air, we talked about the fact that, you know, perhaps we want to look to make sure that there are public members, perhaps even esteemed members of public, and not just those, anybody, people who are in low income circumstances, just a nice, rich representation that can kind of excite, share their own insight on their patient experience. And that ultimately would probably generate a better, more sophisticated, more responsive medical apparatus, I think.
Interesting. But what are you telling me? You go beyond registration. You go beyond registration, and you actually create an environment for the doctors to be able, I mean, physicians generally, to be able to develop themselves, provide up-to-date, self-regulated, development. That's what you're saying, in essence. So you're not just regulating, it's not just punitive, you're creating an environment for the physician to develop themselves. You raise a very important question. I don't know what the Nigerian Mental and Dental Council does. I know that there's some education, but to what degree? And that's one, something that is a page to be lifted from Ontario to make it transparent, to ensure that people are aware, give the voice to the public so that they know that the college, the council represent them as well. Can you just expand on that again to talk about some of the outcome of the college's work and how that has impacted the doctors and the patient? Some of these things. Do you have any data or any indication of how these innovations have impacted the quality of the work by the doctors?
You know, it's so interesting because there was, I remember back in February, I was just blown away by how, and this, but nowadays you have all these kind of really, really, I don't want to use the word sophisticated, but these well thought out systems of measurement, you know, in terms of performance. And they had a whole schedule of metrics upon which they were assessing. And the average, I mean, it was like ridiculous amounts, about 30% more efficiency and impact, 30% more year, 20% more there and there. So I can't go back specifically and kind of cite what that was, but I can just tell you how I felt leaving that space, understanding, holy crap, there's some movement happening. But when we come back and look at what's happening on the ground, again, the key piece, the ground back home in Nigeria and elsewhere in the African diaspora, the key piece is how do we catch up? How do we kind of make sure that our first of all, there's a psychological, cultural piece that must happen, that doctors recognize they're not just quote-unquote big men or big women, but in fact they are people who are carrying on a very, very tremendous responsibility as far as caring for the people, the sick, the wounded, the hurt, the indigent people, end of life, all these kinds of important responsibilities, you know. But at the same time, there has to be some sort of a dialogue, you know, to kind of understand what we're doing, what we're not doing as best as we could, and what we could do better, you know. And I don't know if I really, really answered that question effectively, but the short answer, again, I tend to do that, give a big answer, and the short answer would be yes, there are tools out there, metrics that are there. I can actually provide that to you, because I remember it was such an impressive deck, but technology innovation and outreach and remediation, all those things are generating kind of results. You know, it's not this confrontational, you are a bad doctor thing. I heard a question that came in from Lagos, you know, can we publicly report bad doctors? Well, in Nigeria, who will we report the bad doctor to? You know, So I think even what we're doing in Ontario probably has better applicability to the cultural dynamics that we have back home, you know, where, you know, people become, you know, I won't say islands onto themselves, but, you know, there's sort of a sort of power imbalance. And being a doctor back home, you kind of have enjoy those fruits. So the vocation itself does not improve in the absence of that kind of back and forth and rigorous interaction and input receiving from the public. So whatever systems we can to kind of generate that kind of input will certainly be helpful. And so remediation as opposed to a confrontation perhaps might be one of the ways we can go forward with that.
You bet. And there's another question. You're talking about a question from the public. Here's a question from England. Mm-hmm. This question is from Rotimi. And he says, is there a disparity of foreign doctors brought before the disciplinary panel? Is there a disparity? Do you tend to have more foreign doctors compared to...
Wow, that's a good one. You know, I'm trying to be careful here now. Actually, I can talk about this because this somehow, some way, this will be public. I kind of noticed that. I kind of noticed that. A lot of names I see, and this is not scientific by any means, so, but it kind of strikes me that there's a pattern, and maybe it's my own instinct, right, being a black man. I kind of look and go, if I see the name is the last name, that doesn't seem like a irregular... like a name that is not, that sounds like it could be a non, I'm trying to be too political here and too careful.
What you're saying is this, there is, whether it's a perception, you may not have the statistics, but it will strike you that you have non Caucasian names or non-familiar names. And it's a question, it may be there's something that strikes you. We don't know the data. I certainly haven't looked at it. But if so, yes, there may be reason why this is. I mean, the question of personality, the question of presentation. But then whether or not there's a higher number, the investigation goes through the process, detailed process, and there's a well representation for whosoever is brought before the CPSO to ensure that you follow the proper procedure.
Mm. And that's a good point because, again, as I flesh it out, I'll just say this. I see a lot of Asian, South Asian names that seem to be in trouble. I see a few Nigerian names that, and I don't know if it's my own bias that I'm looking out for that or not, you know, but... I'll have to go back and I can probably find some data and really kind of see. I don't know if anybody's even tracking that kind of data. But again, you kind of touched on why something like that might happen. You know, if we assume that there's even a possibility that is happening, it would largely be, but part of that might be cultural biases that come into place. You know, not only cultural biases in terms of the patient here or self receiving the care, but also just that some people, for example, not looking someone in the eye or the way you talk, or one of the doctors didn't want to, you know, even though he was a GP, he didn't want to do a lot of these tests on women, you know, and I don't know if the religion comes into space or so on and so forth. And these are some of the things you get complaints about, you know. And what I think I find, which is encouraging, and should also be encouraging to the listeners, is with this new focus on equity and diversity and inclusion, there's this lens we're bringing to where you're actually looking at these cases. There's a sad case with a black woman lost her, lost her child. And, without going into deep into the details, a lot of it had to do with the way in which the doctors diagnosed her, missing a lot of indicators because she was a black woman, you know, some of those variables. So I was very, very impressed and encouraged by my colleagues, the actual the medical professionals on the panel who also were able to make that assessment. And together we understood that one of the sanctions that we, because we come with our disposition and rulings, we have a whole series of rulings. We come up with anything from a statement of expectations to actually prescribing undertaking. You must go and read this. You must go and study this. You must go and attend this class. You must go to this treatment. I've been in participant to the suspending doctors. I've had doctors removed from serving in the province of Ontario. I've chastised doctors in what we call cautions. You know, you are, somebody asked about bad doctors. And what we can do, again, that's probably a little bit away from the remediative component, but you're actually doing the finger wagging. Look, dude, you are a bad doctor. If you don't stop this, we're going to have to take further or more serious action. And then also learning the process, right? Sometimes you want to send them to a discipline tribunal right away where they can be, have the whole specter of consequences. But at the same time, to get the discipline, there might be all the steps. So we're not just me and the four or five doctors making a decision. Again, we have a whole plethora of legal advisors and medical advisors. And for me, it's always, especially when I think a doctor is a risk to the public by virtue of practice, I said, what's the most, and I'll ask my legal advisors, what is the most expedient way that I can get this person out of a space where he or she is providing service to the public? And then they'll say, well, Mr. Sherman, you can do this, do this, do this, do this. So bang. So instead of me waiting 2 or 3 months to put a doctor before discipline tribunal, I can actually have an undertaking where within right away, immediately, you have to do such and such and such and such and such, or else your license is suspended. And so we've done that, especially in cases of incapacity, you know, where a doctor, his or herself, might be having some sort of a mental issue, you know, and all of a sudden you have, there was one situation, again, I'm going to be very careful here, where, because I know anecdotes are also better for the public to engage. There was one situation where we were looking at this guy's profile. Was a dude, you need to shut it down. You know, he was young, relatively young, in the early 70s. You need to, and he was looking at expanding. You know, he had a huge clientele.
Caseload.
Hundreds and hundreds. He was looking at expanding. And what we were able to do was, listen, dude, this is what we think. Yes, the undertaking, we made it so restrictive that this subtle suggestion was, dude, you just need to kind of graciously bow out. And he came back to us and said to us, well, instead of me shutting down my practice in October, can I shut it down in December because I serve an underserved population, such and such? We said, do it. And so I felt good. I felt good at night because a bad doctor, reply to our questioner there, was taken out of the system, you know. And you have a lot of things like that.
Yeah, you did it in such a way that you were able to get the doctor to go down, to close up slowly, ensuring that you respect him.
Exactly. Sure
the public.
Precisely.
Here's another question. How do you ensure that doctors on your register are up to date? That's another question from England. How do you ensure that the doctors on your register are up to date in their medical knowledge? What do you do?
Well, a lot of the things we do is against prescribing just that, you know. Obviously, we just can't go willy-nilly. I mean, there's a high degree of remedial training that is offered. And I think, again, in the vocation, you can probably speak better to it, AG. I'm sure they're pounding on your doors over and over. Take this, learn that, you know. And then there's metrics of performance. And if a doctor wants to remain relevant, I know that, for example, my dermatologist tells me that every freaking year he has to go for skills upgrading or skills modification. So I don't know if you do that in your space as well. So the doctors,
you're absolutely correct. There's the CMEs that you have to, the number of CME you've got to get, you know, continuing medical education. So there is, in filling the registration letter annually, we have to report to you guys to say, this is what we've done and we've met the criteria. If there's been any charges, if there's any incapacity, we've got to report to you. And it is after we've reported that to you that you then go ahead and say, we are giving you license again. And that's an excellent job that you do. You ensure that we've had the training. Now, as a public regulatory body, how effective is the CPSO in responding to the ever-changing complexity of Ontario medical community? You touch on it. The community is changing. You have people from all over the world coming. How does the CPSO handle all this?
Wow. Well, first of all, and that's a very, very good question. And I think that's what they aspire to. And I talked about that with those five components from right touch regulation, continuous improvement, engagement, and so on and so forth, that they're very, very open to understand that. They understand that to be able to compete and provide services at the level that is satisfactory in this world, you have to be continuously learning. So there are modules and pieces in place to welcome, expand, evolve, and try to lead the medical community. I think we're ranked, and again, these numbers are better. I should know them as well, but we do very well in that space. But The short answer is there's a mechanism in place where we're trying continuously by those five tenets I talked about, right touch regulation, quality care, continuous improvement, system collaboration, and meaningful engagement to continue improving the capacity to deliver patient-centered care to the public.
No discussion on this program ends without you talking about COVID. We're coming out of COVID, hopefully, fingers crossed. Things are opening up. I'm sure you are as excited as myself, and I'm sure you've been had a double vaccine. Have you?
Of course. I couldn't get it quick enough. Let me tell you.
There you go.
Has the COVID vaccine pandemic impacted on CPSO's mandate? If so, how?
You've known me for a while. I try never to get mad, sort of like you, right? And I kind of shut my microphone down one or two times. In these meetings, you're not allowed to not be on camera, right? So you can't, unlike other Zoom meetings where you can turn your camera must be on the entire time. And you try not to be biased, you know, but I kind of think that what's most exasperating about this particular discussion is the fact that it's a space of science-based. I get most upset when we look at nurses and perhaps even some doctors who are buying into this disinformation and misinformation. There's publicly documented cases of a doctor in Northern Ontario who was just given exempt letters all willy-nilly. Exemptions from from vaccines willy-nilly. We have to kind of intercede very, very quickly, you know? COVID has been a test, and these guys are writing for a case to come before the panel, the ICRC panel, one of which I sit on. There has to be a clear doctor-patient relationship situation, and something that came out of that as a result, some sort of disagreement or whatnot. But yeah, you have cases where people are submitting complaints, you know, based on, for example, just the person's job or vocation. Who is the chief medical officer of Ontario? Who is the chief medical officer of the city of Toronto or Ottawa? So that becomes the accused. And then the case will be, you're calling up the Nuremberg laws. You're talking about Magna Carta. You're talking about human rights codes. And they're just grabbing all kinds of nonsense that is being fed by some sort of a misinformed or misintended propaganda center that emanates out of seven centers in the United States, you know? So with the proliferation of social media, that's where the damaging, if you want to talk about the source and the center of the problem, that's where the problems start, because it's science-based. You can understand to a certain extent the general public, all right, being, vulnerable to that kind of disinformation, but medical doctors, nurses, you know, who are supposed to be so steeped and influenced by science, the data, you follow the data, where the data takes you. And it's irrefutable, you know? So that's the space of exasperation and frustration that I'm talking about there. But,
Interesting. I'm sure the job you're doing is for humanity. You've done a lot of job, and I can see that even your lexicon has improved. You're now using all the medical terminologies. You know what, Fred? I would love to have this discussion with you for a very long time. And you've done very well today sharing your experience. I want to thank you on behalf of our listeners. And I believe those who are listening in Nigeria and all over the world who have listened to your role as a public member will pick one or two lessons. And I'm hoping that we can bring healthcare regulation to the level that you are operating, the space in which you operate. The power disparity is a problem between the doctors, and it's more so in Africa, mainly because of our heritage, where we came from and where we are. And of course, the disparity mars the quality of care. You've shed light today, and on behalf of all the listeners, I say thank you very much. I would like to thank the editorial board. I'd like to thank the producer of this program, and I'd like to thank our listeners, those who sent the question. And we look forward to speaking with you again next week. Remember, next week there's going to be a change of time for listeners outside Nigeria. We're going to be at 1 o'clock because the time will change, and I will be here. My name is A.G. Ahmed, and I will see you soon. Keep safe, keep well, keep listening to Spirit of Nigeria Radio.
Wahala.
Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.